Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is Moolah La, Money Made Simple. You can get almost anything you want delivered to your house in under 24 hours. That's part technology, but mostly the existence of the middleman. And that's both bad and good. Columbia Law professor Catherine Judge explores the middleman economy in her book, Direct: The Rise of the Middleman Economy and the Power of Going to the Source. And you know, a lot of businesses in the middle and small and medium-sized category are middlemen in this economy. How will these businesses do down the road? Jason Charlebois is with Scotiabank. He's the SVP of Small Business Banking, and he's going to be here to discuss its latest report, SMEs, the Shortage Economy. If you are one of those people who gets paid once a month or once every 2 weeks, you're in good company. What if you got paid every single day? Is it more convenient? Would it help you save more money? Wendy De La Rosa is an assistant professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School, and she explored this very question in a research study called The Impact of Payment Frequency on Consumer Spending. She's going to be here to talk about that. Plus, one share of Tesla is almost $1,000. That is a huge sum if you've only got $1,000 to save. There's a new investing platform coming that's going to allow you to buy a fraction of one of those Tesla shares. Taryn Kane, the CEO of Flamingo. It's an investment platform that allows people to buy fractional shares with as little as a dollar in more than 2,000 companies. This has been a big thing in the U.S. over the last couple of years. It's becoming a bigger thing here in Canada, too. And we'll talk to Nathan Kennedy, personal finance content creator, about his TikTok, his Instagram, his podcast called New Money. This is Moolah La, Money Made Simple, brought to you in part by Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country, and by Home Equity Bank, provider of the CHIP reverse mortgage. Let's get started. We have all learned the hard way that global events can have a huge impact on the supply chain. But according to my next guest, this is just one part of a much larger problem with what she calls the middleman economy. Catherine Judge is a financial regulations expert and Columbia Law professor. She joins me now to talk about her book, Direct: The Rise of the Middleman Economy and the Power of Going to the Source. She's in New York City today. Hello there, Catherine.
Hi, Bruce. Good to be here.
What do you mean when you reference the middleman economy? Isn't that just the economy? I mean, it's been a heck of a long time since people dealt exclusively human to human.
It's true. Middlemen have been around for a very long time, providing a lot of value for a really long time. When I reference the middleman economy, what I really talk about is the more recent phenomenon where we've had the growth of these incredibly large middlemen that both feed and are fed by these incredibly complex supply chains, and how that's really changed what we understand, what we know, what we see, the resilience or lack thereof of the system in really meaningful ways. There's been a shift in power from all of the creators and the consumers to the middlemen, and it's understanding how this shift has occurred.
Right. So you don't have a problem with the fact that I can go to a grocery store instead of having to drive out to a farm and pick up the head of broccoli specifically from the farmer. You're okay that I buy some things from a grocery store, but you have concerns. So sure, there are pros. There are some cons. What are some cons as it relates to how the economy exists today?
Yeah. So, I mean, the goal is certainly not a world without middlemen. They're here to stay, and they provide a lot of value. The cons really come in twofold. One is as these supply chains become longer and more complex, it introduces new sources of fragility, and we're often not aware of that fragility until it becomes manifest in a really big way. We saw that in 2007, where these long securitization chains supposedly made the allocation of money more efficient and made it easier to get a loan, but then resulted in a collapse of the financial system, spillovers to the real economy. We're seeing it right now with the supply chain collapses. So one is fragility. The other is a lack of accountability. A lot of people today care about reasonably priced goods. They care about risk-adjusted returns, but they also care about worker impact. They care about environmental impact. And these chains have been created, so we really can't understand those consequences. And these little labels just don't tell us what we need to know.
there is a cost to dealing more directly with producers. And I know that because I go to a farmer's market and the cost of a head of cauliflower there is double what it would be if it was the cost that I were to pay getting it, you know, from a grocery store shipped in from who knows where, thousands of miles away. How does that factor into this? Because you could argue that it is the privileged upper income folks who can afford to pay that incremental price, and people who are more cash constrained, they actually need to shop at Walmart.
Yeah, and there's a trade-off both ways. I mean, one of the core challenges is prices have been in many ways artificially low because we allowed for a lot of fragility that now is causing prices to escalate really quickly, and people are struggling to even meet their basic costs. So part of the challenge is that like the process of changing production so that, you know, the cauliflower was grown overseas and then had to be shipped here through how many different like layers, it's hard to know, actually meant that you might have cauliflower and you want it, or it might not be available. So that's part of it. And the other is key to recognizing, as we start to shorten supply chains, as we create more accountability, you're also going to have more gains oftentimes flowing to workers. So it's not just our status as consumers that clearly is going to be part of it, but think about kind of the other roles that we play in our lives. So yeah, farmers markets are great. They're going to be a niche product. Though nicely, actually, in the United States, a lot of the SNAP, EBT, and other food benefits can be used at farmers markets. Mm. And I think that's a great innovation. But it is understanding like this is just part of a rebalancing. It's not getting rid of intermediation.
You referenced the financial crisis and all of the surprises that were unveiled in 2008, 2009. In today's context, where does the middleman economy live in the investing world in a problematic way, in your opinion?
Yeah, I mean, so we have had a very healthy rebalancing in banks, I think. The securitization chains early along have gotten a lot shorter. The overall system in some ways has gotten simplified. But in the focus on banks, there's really been a spillover to other parts of the financial system that continue to be more opaque. We've also seen a significant rise in the growth and the power of asset managers. It used to be people in the United States who owned their stock directly. They were able to vote those shares. Today, the great majority of that is going through asset managers with three mutual funds really playing a huge role. And now they have all this voting power, but they weren't necessarily chosen to have that kind of power. So a lot of it just like, let's understand the concentrations of power that the system creates.
There are a ton of direct to consumer brands out there in almost every category that you can think of. Are they a part of the solution?
I think they are a part of the solution. They're an incomplete part, but they are. And I think they're also a sign that people didn't like what was happening. People realized that if they wanted more sustainability, if they wanted to understand impact, they needed to actually create new supply chains, start from the bottom up to create a system that was meant to promote sustainability and accountability, and also connection with a customer. And so it's a very different experience. Again, there's been a lot of money flowing into it. So that has resulted in a lot of pressures to grow really quickly. And at times has caused some of those companies to deviate from their original aims. And it just changes. A lot of the beauty of a true direct model is there's a relationship between the producer and all of the consumers and the customers. And once you have this very, very powerful kind of third party VC shaping the evolution of the company, that corrupts and changes the system a little bit. So certainly part of the solution, but not the only part of it.
I offer five principles here. Intermediation matters. Shorter is better. Okay, we know about the 100-mile diet and all that. Sure. direct is best, you argue. You also say we need to follow the fees. What does that mean?
Follow the fees is one of the most important, precisely because we're not going to forego middlemen entirely. The idea behind follow the fees is understand how the middlemen in your life make their money. So for example, you're trying to save for retirement and you're trying to make choices over how to allocate that money. It's a really confusing process. So some people just go with index funds. Other people want a little handholding. There's two ways to do that. One, you can actually pay somebody to come up with a plan, but then you're writing them a check. The other is you have somebody who pretends to provide a bunch of services for free, but then puts you in a bunch of investments that is churning additional fees that are helping to go to that broker. That second model is going to feel less expensive to you up front, but over time, it's going to cost you a heck of a lot more. Mm-hmm. So a lot of it is understanding how intermediaries, how the middlemen that you're relying on are what their business model is and how they're making money. And so you can figure out, do I trust this person? Do I not trust this person? Or like, when can I forgo their services entirely?
Principle five is bridges can help. You don't mean that literally. What do you mean?
So the reality is a lot of the direct trade that happens today is local. It's you going to your farmer's market, but we live in a hierarchical and in some ways still segregated society. There's incredible wealth disparities around the world. But part of what the book explores, there's an incredible opportunity right now to use other ways of understanding community that go beyond geography. So you have some really innovative entrepreneurs who are starting beauty companies and spice companies and really helping to connect consumers in Europe and North America with creators in South America, in Africa, and creating the transparency, allowing you to see what's there. So whether it's a shared joy, a shared passion, a shared challenge that you're facing, or it's kind of a community that's defined by wanting a particular type of product, it's trying to understand how we can use direct connection, thanks to technology, to actually create transparency and connection in ways that go beyond the local.
I have oversimplified your thesis in this short interview. There is much more here in the book, but I do want to finish with one last question, and that is, what's your call to action? What do you want me to do differently? What do you want our listeners to do differently in the context of the real power shift that has unfolded in the last couple of decades?
Yeah. So first of all, a lot of it's for policymakers. It's recognizing it's just too hard for individuals not to go to the largest middlemen, and policymakers have a role to play. But for individuals, it is reflecting more on the choices that you're making. The core idea in the book is when we understand these big structures, we can make better decisions day to day. Relying on a middleman is almost always the easier choice. Sometimes for that reason, it's the right choice. But there's going to be times where opting out allows you to build a sense of connection, allows you to get a little more meaning, allows you to have an experience you could never otherwise buy in isolation. So it's starting to become more thoughtful, not only about what you're buying and how you're investing, but through whom you're buying and through whom you're investing, and the implications for yourself and for the world that you live in.
Catherine, thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
Catherine Judge is a professor at Columbia Law. She is the author of Direct, The Rise of the Middleman Economy and the Power of Going to the Source. And I should say, for the record, that cauliflower at the farmer's market, as exorbitant as the price may be, tastes better than anything you could ever buy in a grocery store.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
There isn't enough. There is not enough wood to build a deck, not enough PSWs for long-term care, not enough time in the day for another and another and another Zoom meeting. How does all this scarcity affect small and medium-sized businesses? For more on this, we're going to talk to Jason Charlebois. He is the Senior Vice President of Small Business Banking at Scotiabank, and he's going to talk about their latest report, SMEs, The Shortage Economy. Hello, Jason.
Hi, Bruce. Thanks for having me today.
You're welcome. We are a personal finance show, but what we know is a lot of our listeners run small and medium-sized businesses. So this topic is really relevant, not in terms of, you know, how they're investing for retirement, but how they run their businesses. And they feel the shortages. We feel the shortages. Paint the picture here for what businesses are dealing with at this time.
You highlighted it in your open, Bruce. The shortage economy is unfortunately upon us in terms of whether it be labor, whether it be inputs to the supply chain or the supply chain itself. Businesses have to be, as always, and entrepreneurial businesses especially, entrepreneurial. They have to be adaptable. They have to be very thoughtful in their planning for how to manage through the times ahead as it relates to what's going on both geopolitically and what's going on in our economy, because we're seeing unprecedented behaviors and attributes in our economy that definitely have a direct impact on small business.
What is easier for small business in these times, and what is harder. I mean, you know, one example would be if you're a massive retailer, you can charter a jet and bring product over on in cargo. You can't do that if your business is, you know, Etsy and you're trying to, you know, deliver your products domestically.
Yeah. So as you said, many things are harder in terms of planning cash flow, enabling digital capabilities for the business, as many did through COVID, to do curbside pickup, have online storefronts, availability of resources. The things that are easier is understanding the cash flow and the economics of your business to make sure that you're pricing properly, to protect your margins, to protect your revenue streams, and making sure that you're planning ahead. And that involves having a great A team of advisors around you. That can be a small business advisor from Scotiabank. It might be your accountant. It could be a lawyer. It could be other specialists that are in your network to make sure that you're factoring in all of the considerations for how your unique business in this economic environment needs to plan to stay strong and viable looking forward.
I referenced off the top how hard it is to find PSWs to work in long-term care. That is the same for service roles really across the economy. Is it harder for small business in that they probably have less in terms of, you know, traditional benefits, or they might be more margin constrained? What context would you provide on the labor piece of the shortage economy?
Well, Canada for the first time is actually seeing more unfilled job vacancies than people looking for jobs, meaning that, you know, there's more employment opportunities than there are people to fill those employment opportunities. So that is affecting businesses of all sizes. The small businesses are actually feeling some of those constraints a little less, meaning that their access to some of the supply of labor that they need is being impacted, but not as significantly as some of the larger enterprise firms that are looking for certain types of skills and certain types of workers. So it's a challenge for all types of businesses, but in that space, the small businesses have reported seeing less of a direct impact.
There's a cost to borrowing connected to the Bank of Canada and rates, and there's a cost or availability of money to borrow based on what the banks decide to do, either because of the regulator or just their internal conservatism that may be increasing on concerns about a recession at some point. What's your sense for the availability of capital for small business? Are things starting to tighten up already?
I would say that the industry and Scotiabank specifically is there for small businesses. A business owner who's looking for capital in these times to help stave off, you know, the higher input costs and have the inflationary effects on their business. We have a wide range of solutions and products to meet those needs, and our commitment to supporting small businesses is still fully available and there for any business that's listening today. I encourage you to talk to one of our small business advisors. You can book an appointment online through scotiabank.com/small business.
So one last question here. In your Path to Impact report, one of the calls to action was around digital capability. And that small businesses who invested in that digital capability would be better positioned to withstand whatever lies ahead from an economic perspective. What does that mean? What does that specifically mean? Because I can think of lots of examples of what digital means. I don't know if they would have me able to withstand economic challenges if I just moved to Google Docs or built an app.
Yeah, I think the messaging there around moving to digital is really about creating efficiencies in the operations of your business. Obviously, traditional ways of check and cash moving to digital money movement, which obviously banks like Scotiabank have a wide range of products to allow businesses to receive and make payments in a more effective way, which obviously brings revenue forward, allows payables to be managed more effectively, and giving the business owners more time to focus on running the business. And then secondly, as I talked about a little bit earlier, just around taking advantage of opening up your distribution channels within your small business, right? So if you're a traditional brick and mortar business sitting in a local community, there's now many ways for you to to broaden the reach of your proposition to more customers through taking advantage of e-commerce and the various different ways that and the way that consumers are now moving away from, not in full force, but away from the way they traditionally bought their goods and services to a mixture of traditional and now digital. So being a small business owner with digital is a critical capability as you look about sustaining your business over the medium and longer term.
Interesting. Jason, thanks for your time today.
Thank you very much for having me, Bruce.
Jason Charlebois, Senior Vice President of Small Business Banking at Scotiabank. He was here to talk about their report, SMEs or SMEs, the shortage economy. Stay with us. Coming up next on Moolala, why spreading out your paychecks may actually help you save more. What? Wendy De La Rosa from the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School takes us through the findings of a study she co-authored. And later, personal finance content creator Nathan Kennedy is here to tell us about his videos and his new money podcast. If you want to stay up to date on all things Moolala, and who doesn't? Very simple. We have a newsletter. Sign up for that newsletter on moolala.ca. You'll hear about stuff we're doing on this show on Sirius XM, CBC Radio, CityLine, and BNN Bloomberg.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Welcome back. Moolala, Money Made Simple is brought to you in part by Credit Canada. I am the CEO of the organization, and we are Canada's longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. Our mission is to help people get out of debt so they can get back into life. Listen, debt is a brutal reality for millions of Canadians. It starts to pile on for lots and lots of different reasons: job loss, divorce, illness, bad luck, you name it. Our accredited credit counselors are available to help you understand your current financial situation and take you through all your options on how to move forward. And there really are options out there. So go to creditcanada.com. We are a nonprofit, as I said. The counseling is free and judgment free. One of the things that can be really tough to manage is the timing of your income and expenses. You know, even if you've got enough to pay the bills, sometimes it doesn't arrive in your bank account at the appropriate time. Gersh Singh is going to join us for this conversation with our next guest. Gersh, what do you think? Would it be better or worse for you if you got paid every single day, or if you got paid, you know, once a month and all of your bills were due like the next day? Wouldn't that be the easiest way?
Maybe. In some ways, it would be a lot easier to manage cash flow if I got paid once a month. But I've been stuck in the biweekly loop for years, so I couldn't imagine getting paid every day. We are going to talk about payment frequency. Wendy De La Rosa is an assistant professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School and co-author of a study called The Impact of Payment Frequency on Consumer Spending and Subjective Wealth Perceptions. She joins us now from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, to help us to understand what that means. So, Wendy, what was the question you were trying to answer in your research?
Thanks, Gersh, and I'm so happy to be here. So my question really came out of a family chat. I had a cousin of mine who was part of the ride-sharing community, and he was just so excited that he could now get paid every day. And I went back to the office and I started to ruminate, well, how does this change consumer spending or consumer behavior? You know, you could think about it as maybe it's a net good because I don't have to wait until Friday if rent is due on the 31st. If I need the liquidity push, maybe that's helpful. But what we know about psychology is that we're complex human beings. And so I thought that it would also change how we think about our resources. And so that fundamentally, that was the question that we set out to answer.
What is the current state for most people? Are most people paid monthly? Are they paid biweekly? Gig economy workers may be paid by the ride after they finish the drive. The amount shows up in their bank account. Give us the context here.
Yeah, so according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, about 8% of us get paid on a monthly basis. Right? Mostly everybody else is on a biweekly, semi-monthly, or weekly. And a lot of that is coded into law based out of the labor movement. And so, you know, you had employers who would last years before they paid you. And so a lot of low-income work is codified that says you have to pay people at least once every 15 days or at least once every 30 days. However, in the past couple of years, we've seen this move towards daily pay. And so Walmart workers can now get paid every day. Even McDonald's workers in certain franchises can now get paid every day. It's this sort of growing movement because, again, the thesis is maybe this will help people's financial well-being. Right. And, you know, our research suggests that it may not.
And it being more frequent, what are some of the benefits? And sorry, not more frequent, it being more a general practice today, what are the benefits for the worker of getting paid more frequently?
You know, so the benefits that are being purported out there is to say, look, like maybe it's going to help people manage their cash flow better because, you know, they don't have to wait 2 weeks in order to get their money. But again, that sort of treats humans as robots, that all I'm doing is waiting for income to come in and, you know, I never have wants and desires and needs, right? And our spending is fixed when we know that our spending is not fixed. Right. My likelihood of eating out or my likelihood of ordering takeout is by and large emotional. It's whether or not I'm tired today or whether or not I feel like cooking. And so we have a lot of these non-necessary expenditures that are not fixed, and they're all based on our perceptions of how much money we think we have.
The biggest pitfall that I can see would be the requirement that a human has to save and budget for big expenses, because your rent's coming out once a month, your mortgage is coming out once a month, your cell phone bill is coming out once a month. Surely that's a big challenge for people who would get paid more frequently.
So Bruce, I think you're spot on. So here's what we found. First, we looked at the banking transactions of about 30,000 consumers just to see like what's happening in the real world. Is there even an association with higher payment frequency, meaning you, if you get paid more frequently, what happens to your spending? And what we found systematically, even after we control for your income, time of year, et cetera, the more frequently you get paid, the more number of expenditures, the higher number of expenditures you end up making. So you make more purchases throughout the month. And then as a result, you end up spending more. And you end up spending more mostly on discretionary expenditures. The effects are larger for lower income communities and higher income consumers. And what's really interesting about this is that when you look at that correlation, that association, if you take someone who is getting paid once a month and you put them in the context where they're now getting paid every weekday, our model suggests that someone would spend an extra $250 or more, which is more than double than what we spend annually on books, newspapers, and magazines combined. Right? So these are real dollars that are leaving people. And we also found the positive association with higher bank fees and overdrafts.
So Wendy, why do you think that more frequent paychecks have the opposite effect on savings than they do in helping people to keep up with their bill payments? And, you know, the idea of increasing the frequency is to help people to keep up. So why does it have the opposite effect?
Yeah, so that's when we went to the lab and made it and systematically manipulated how often people got paid through a series of life simulations. And what we found there is that when you get paid more frequently, you have less uncertainty, you feel less uncertainty over whether or not you can make it through the month. Because you're like, I'm gonna get paid tomorrow. So there's less uncertainty. And that lower uncertainty increases the perception of how much money you think you have. We all know people who are millionaires who feel like they're extremely financially constrained. And we all know people who are extremely financially constrained who feel like they're affluent, right? And so one of the things that we know from prior literature is that our subjective wealth perceptions are oftentimes more predictive of our spending patterns than our objective wealth, right? And we find that even controlling for objective wealth, these subjective wealth perceptions are what drive spending. So
there has been a tremendous amount of research in behavioral economics, right? Thaler and the gang have been working on this for decades. What about this research adds to that conversation, or maybe even contradicts what we knew to date about how people behave when it comes to money?
So here's what we add. A lot of standard economic models rely on this really boring theory called the permanent income hypothesis, which says, which just says people make decisions about their spending based on their lifetime earnings estimate. And it doesn't really matter, absent liquidity constraints, it doesn't really matter how often they get money, when they get it, timing concerns are irrelevant. And so this research really speaks to that body of work that says, no, wait a minute. No, people aren't standing in line at Starbucks saying, you know what, my lifetime earnings estimate increased by $2, therefore I can spend, you know, I can upgrade on my latte. That's not how people operate in the world. And so that Thaler gang that says we need to treat humans not as superhumans, but as the beautiful, fallible, imperfect humans that we are.
Yeah. And I'm in that Starbucks line wondering which donut I'm going to jam in my face and then lie to Noom about it because it didn't happen. Gersh, one more question and then we'll have to wrap up.
Well, you are doing a follow-up study. What's it all about?
Yeah, so, you know, there's a couple of things that are really concerning to us. So a lot of these like InstaPay programs charge a fee for people to access their money instantly. And so if you look at someone who's earning $15 a day, the APR on that, if you calculate that, if someone decides to cash out every day, is worse than a payday loan, right? That's not the world that we want to live in. That's not what we want to do. And so I think there's like a lot of follow-up studies that need to happen to look at the long-term financial implications of these types of payments and how they fundamentally change people's savings over the long run.
Fascinating stuff. Wendy, thank you for your time today.
Always a pleasure.
Wendy De La Rosa is co-author of a study on the impact of payment frequency. She is an assistant professor at UPenn's Wharton School.
Hi, it's me, your debt. Look, we need to talk. This isn't working. The missed payments, the collection calls, and all those sleepless nights. We need nonprofit debt counseling, and I found the perfect place. Credit Canada Debt Solutions. They're non-judgmental, 100% confidential. They'll negotiate with creditors and even stop interest. Don't you want to rebuild your credit? You deserve better.
Break up with debt. Visit creditcanada.com.
Coming up later, I'll speak to personal finance content creator Nathan Kennedy about his new money podcast. But first, Taryn Kaint is here to talk about Flamingo. It's an investing platform that will allow you to buy fractional shares of companies for as little as a dollar. Good idea? Bad idea? I don't know. And if this is not enough moolala for you, which of course it is not, you need to head on over to moolala.ca. So on the website, you can find links to all past episodes over the last 5 years. You can search by guest name, by topic, or you can do a similar search on any of the podcast platforms, Spotify, Stitcher, Amazon Prime, whatever it is. While you're there, write us a review. How fun would that be?
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Fractional ownership has been a thing for a very long time. Condos, remember timeshares? You could do timeshares in like the 70s and 80s. These days, there's a lot of fractional investing opportunities. So in addition to timeshares, there's art, there's music royalties, there's wine. The same can for investing increasingly. You can buy, it's easier to buy a fraction of an entire share. And there is a Canadian investment platform that is soon to launch. It is called Flamingo. And we're going to talk to the CEO of the company, Taryn Kaint. He joins us from Calgary. Hello there.
Hey, Bruce, how's it going? Thank you so much for having me. Excited to chat with you about Flamingo and what we're working on.
You are developing the product. You're not in market yet, but I wanted to have this conversation because I think it's a really interesting take on investing. How will it work?
Flamingo is a commission-free fractional investing app
really we're changing the way that Canadians invest. And the way that we look at our model is we use something called pies and slices. Essentially, users are coming onto our application and creating custom portfolios of the companies that they know and love, and they're able to invest as little as $1 into over 4,200 companies that we have on our platform. So the power of fractional shares really allows you to buy companies like Amazon, Google, which trade for thousands of dollars. I mean, Amazon before the stock split, and it allows for accessibility to any of the companies without having to break the bank. And I'll talk a little bit more about our pies and slices model later, but really the focus on Flamingo is what we called empowered investing. We're allowing Canadians to make better, more informed decisions and allowing to have accessibility and all the knowledge that they need within one application, and really focusing on education as well with our bite-sized integrated content and immersive educational experience called Flamingo Central, which I will also talk about later. But really, the reason why we started and what Flamingo is really meant for is looking at how, investing is not intuitive for the young Canadian. More than 70% of Canadian millennials save, but only 40% invest. The biggest reason is there's perceived barriers and complexities that Canadians think about investing that are deterring them from making better decisions. And that's where we come in.
You said commission free, is that correct?
That is correct.
So how do you make your money? How do you make your money?
Yeah, great question. So we charge foreign exchange fees on U.S. equities available to trade. We have dedicated U.S. cash accounts. So really, you only have to convert once over when you're bringing in your Canadian dollars, and then you can trade unlimited U.S. equities. And then when you decide to liquidate your account or take out your funds, then we would charge a foreign exchange fee then as well.
Another way into fractional investing is an exchange traded fund. It's different because it's a basket of stocks that mirror an index typically. Why actual fractional shares in terms of owning a piece of Amazon instead of owning a NASDAQ ETF?
At the end of the day, users want choice. They want to be able to invest in companies that they know and love. If I shop at Amazon, I want to be able to own a piece of Amazon. If I'm buying a coffee at Starbucks, I don't want a piece of Starbucks. Really, you cannot do that in an ETF. An ETF is a basket of multiple companies, and there might be certain companies that you don't want to support. So there's also the socially responsible investing component of this, where there might be certain companies that might not be ethical, that you do not want to put your dollars towards. So with fractional investing, you're not only investing in companies that you love, but you're investing with your dollars and so you support. And that's where you're really able to individualize and create your own ETF-esque portfolios on the Flamingo application. They're not ETFs, again. They're custom portfolios that you're creating of companies that you know and love. But this way, you have the flexibility to really choose what you do and don't want to put into your portfolio.
This is already a thing in the United States, and it's incumbent brokerages like TD Ameritrade, like Schwab, big, big players. And then the upstart, Robinhood, has been big in this game. And Robinhood has received a fair amount of flack for its, facilitation or enablement of a lot of some of the very volatile stock trading that we have seen. Do you have a concern, in particular for younger people, about getting in over their heads as a potential market correction looms over us?
I think in the end of the day, people underestimate how smart millennial and Gen Zs are. And really, that's kind of the rhetoric that the big banks are brought in to make finance complicated, really difficult. And therefore, they're charging these massive MER fees and big fees that you're paying over to the banks, when really investing is not that difficult. Once you get the right education, the right tools that allow you to enable and understand how to do it, you're able to do it yourself. It takes practice, like everything else in life. And that's really where the Flamingo app comes in. We're focused on longer term investing. We're not looking to have day traders come onto our platform and create this into a community of day traders. This is a community of long-term investors that are looking at creating long-term wealth. And when you look at the stock market, the S&P 500 over the last 100 years, it has trended upward. We've had cycles of boom and bust, but a long-term investor is not looking at, hey, I want to put in $100 because I want a quick 10X on my capital. A long-term investor is looking at, hey, I may get that 10X over 50 years, but these are companies that I know and love. I'm interacting with every single day, and I understand their business models and fundamentals. Therefore, I want to own a piece of these companies. Mm. And so I think that's where we come in. The big difference
I love a good David and Goliath story. I love it. And you've got some real competition, not just from incumbent financial institutions, but from the robo-advisor sector. So this is something that Wealthsimple allows its clients to do. How on earth do you think that you can compete with them?
I think the team at Wealthsimple has done an exceptional job in regards to, you know, bringing in what we call investing 1.0. So this is where you had your digital brokerages that enabled the everyday investor to get access to the markets. Where Flamingo comes in is we're pioneering investment 2.0. We're allowing people to have everything in their investment application, allowing for flexibility, zero commissions, but also allowing them to have an immersive experience with their community and learning at the same time. So it's not just one facet of, hey, we have an amazing investment application. You're able to learn with your community. You're able to learn with the people around you. And also putting all of these amazing financial tools with education together is what we believe is the next facet and next gen of financial education and financial literacy, and you know, the next evolution of where these financial apps will go. So kudos to the team at Wealthsimple. They've done an exceptional job, but we're taking their work and really taking it to the next echelon. Mm.
One of the advantages they had, not in their first months, but in their first years, was a massive equity stake from Power Financial, like just real backstop in terms of their heft. How are you funded?
Yeah, so we've raised altogether about $3 million so far. We have phenomenal investors that include friends, family, angel investors, a few funds that are participated, and we have investors all across Canada and a few investors even in the US. Really, these are individuals that understand the struggles of being or having children that are part of this demographic, believe in us, believe in the product, that have really pushed us to get us where we are today. We're a team of 33 across 9 countries today internationally that are building this amazing investment application for Canadians to start off. They're really having a global vision. So we've been able to really have the support of amazing people around us that have got us so far.
I can imagine brand building is one of your big challenges, but a second would be mitigating the risk of a market correction, because it feels so good when the markets are rising. It's fantastic. And we are long, long overdue in this country and really around the world for a significant market correction, even more than we have seen so far. It may happen. It may not happen. The gains may continue, and this could be simply a retrenchment. How do you mitigate the risk of consumer disinterest in your model if the markets decline?
In the end of the day, it's never been more expensive to live. If an average millennial in Gen Z wants to buy a home today, I believe the number is $860,000 to buy a home. You can't really go and build wealth if you're not an accredited investor into companies that are not public. So where do you go? You park your money in a savings account that pays you 0.01% interest. No, because you're financially savvy. You know that you need to be able to create long-term wealth. And that's where the public markets come in, giving accessibility to anyone and everyone. And that really has become top of mind for everyone as it becomes more expensive to live. Right now, you know, in the end of the day, I'm not a betting man. And, you know, it's not my job to say whether the stock market is going to go up or down. But like I said, historically, the S&P 500 and great companies have allowed us to really revolutionize and bring the future forward. I strongly do believe if there's a market correction or whatever's going to happen in the markets, there may be a pullback, there may not be, but investors are savvy. People know that if they want to create long-term wealth and be able to live where the inflation is 8%, the only way for them to really make something out of their money is to invest. And that's where we strongly believe our model is focused on that long-term investor with education. And if we're able to empower them, they'll understand that their time horizon shouldn't be 24 months, but it should be 24 years. And over a time of 24 years, a lot can happen.
Taryn, thank you for your time today.
Thank you so much, Bruce.
Taryn Kainth is the CEO of Flamingo. Its focus is fractional investing. He joined us from Calgary today. Stay with us. Coming up next, I'm going to talk to content creator, personal finance content creator, Nathan Kennedy, about why he wanted to share his love for personal finance on all the right platforms, TikTok, Instagram, all the things. If you have comments for us, please send them by old school email. ask@moolala.ca is the address. Questions, comments, story ideas, whatever it is, ask@moolala.ca. Moolala is sponsored by Home Equity Bank, the provider of the CHIP reverse mortgage. Here's the big idea. It empowers Canadian homeowners age 55 plus to live retirement on their terms by providing them with a safe and easy way to access the equity built up in their home. And given the prices of houses these days, that equity can be considerable. the funds can be used for whatever the client wants or whatever the client needs. And that could be travel, it could be helping grandchildren, or it could be supplementing their day-to-day expenses. You can access up to 55% of your home's value with no monthly mortgage payments required. Go to chip.ca to learn how you can stay in the home you love without having to move or downsize. That's Home Equity Bank.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
There are a lot of personal finance bloggers and TikTokers and Instagrammers and YouTubers and all that that are really doing a great job capturing the zeitgeist and speaking about money in ways that a younger generation can hear. Nathan Kennedy is one of those people. He is a personal finance content creator on TikTok, on Instagram, and the host of the podcast New Money with Nathan Kennedy. He joins us now from Ancaster, Ontario. Hello there.
How are we doing? Thank you for having me.
I am well. Thank you. The personal finance conversation is becoming much broader, more nuanced. There are lots and lots of new voices. What did you feel was missing? Why did you feel like you wanted to pick up the microphone?
I just wanted to do it and speak English because I feel like there's a lot of jargon and a lot of things that, you know, people don't really understand and kind of it's not broken down in a way. And so I felt like there was this gap for, you know, this information to be communicated as if, you know, I always say like, I'm going out to get a drink with you and I'm just explaining something to you as an old friend. And so I felt like there was a huge gap for that. And that's why I just started to create content.
And where did the seed of your interest in personal finance coming from? And I find having talked to lots of people about this, there seems to be two paths. There's one where it was a seed planted and you were raised in a world in which this was a conversation you talked about all the time. And then the other sort of persona are people who had nothing. And then suddenly, for some reason, a light bulb went off and they learned everything that there was to know. Which are you?
The latter. I would say, you know, it started off as me thinking I knew something about money. And when I was in university, I realized that I didn't. And I was actually I had quite poor financial habits. So I went down the rabbit hole of, you know, consumed every piece of content on the internet on personal finance, absolutely became enamored and love it. And so I started to really get into it. And I got to the point where I was like, well, wow, I think I got a little bit of, you know, something, a little bit of personality, whatever. Like, why don't I, you know, do it and put my spin on it and just gave it a shot when I was in school.
What do you think your spin is?
I just think I try to talk very informally. Like, you know, I'm a little bit, you know, looser on the edges. You know, sometimes I'll swear,
do you
whatever.
Use the phrase, what's up, bruh? Yeah. Is that I just, you know, Googled cool phrases for people 20 years younger than me. And that's what I found.
Cool. Yeah. You know, little jargon and things like that. But I just think that a lot of finance, I mean, it's one of the most stuffy industries that there are. And so I just felt like there's a huge opportunity to just kind of talk to my generation in a way where it's really chill. Like, it's just really, you know, I'm not trying to sell you anything. I'm not trying to do anything. I'm just like, hey man, some cool stuff out here. You know, I think you should know about it. And if you don't, I don't care. Like, it's all good.
Give me an example of a topic that you really felt A, that you could sink your teeth into, and B, that resonated with your audience in a way that surprised you.
Negotiating. It's not really, you know, it's not something that is typically talked about in personal finance. But I do think it has a huge implication when it comes to, you know, your job and salary and raises. I think there's a huge financial aspect to that. And so I started to do content around negotiating and saying, hey, just sort of opening up the topic of, yeah, you can ask for a raise. Like, you can negotiate when you're getting a new job. And I found that a lot of people have some deep seated disagreements around, you know, it, because they conflate it with being ungrateful, and take what you can get because the next guy's going to take what you have kind of thing. And so that was a huge thing that I had no idea when I started, because I just thought that was something that we should all be doing, is negotiating our salaries and raises and things like that, and trying to maximize our income, right? Because we can work towards our financial goals. And I got met with a lot of pushback, in good and bad ways. So it was one of the craziest things that I've come across since I started talking about this stuff.
One of the interesting differences amongst those of different ages is investing. And it's not so much the knowledge, it's the lived experience of having been through market corrections. So you're young, you have never been through a market correction. I'm old, I have been through many, so I'm less futzed by a 30 or 40% correction because I've seen it multiple times before. When you look at that broad topic area of investing, how do you account for the fact that you simply haven't lived through what other people have lived through, and you will definitely need to live through a correction at some point?
Yeah, I definitely try to have a respect for it. I think it's something that it is interesting. I always say that, you know, Gen Z and things like that, a lot of Gen Z is very interested in crypto, and crypto is an incredibly volatile asset. Some people have kind of gone through some massive corrections. Now, you're talking about broader market corrections, you know, GFC, dot-com crash, things like that. Absolutely not. Like, I haven't lived through that. I try to always keep that in mind, and you don't know how it is until that actually happens. So I just try to study history as much as I can. I try to share that with my audience as much as I can, so we can have a respect for that and continue to buy and hold through thick and thin.
How do you find the balance of current Nathan versus future Nathan, the dashing dude of 55 years old or 65 years old, who's going to want cash and not have to work for a living at some point? How do you make that call? Because you, like all young people, are faced with tremendous temptation, both in terms of things you would like to buy and bars you would like to go out to.
Yeah, I definitely think people are quite extreme in their views on this. I think you can have your cake and eat it too here, as long as you structure your finances in a way where you're paying yourself first, you're making sure you're getting your RSP matching at work, and you're maxing out your TFSA and doing all those fundamental things. And with the excess money, you can just kind of have fun with. So if you're making sure that your priorities are in check, and you have a little bit of discretionary income afterward, then blow all of it, because all the big rocks are taken care of. And so I really try to implement that. I say, hey, listen, you can become a millionaire at 50, 60 and invest in index funds and things like that. And you can also go to the bar, have a few drinks and not have to worry about it. I think you can have both of those things.
What is your take on real estate? Do you own? If you don't own, are you squirreling away money for a down payment?
Yeah, it's one of those things where I, for the longest time, was saving up for an investment property. But right now I just have some money in some REITs. And I think, yeah, especially in Southern Ontario, the market is quite far away from where Gen Z would like it to be. But I definitely think that you are seeing, with rates going up, but I think the market is cooling off a bit. I don't think there's going to be any sort of crash or anything like that. But right now I'm just in some REITs. I'm probably looking to buy in the next few years, just residentially, but I'm more so just investing back in my business in terms of that. So
real estate investment trust, for those who are like, wait, Nathan said no jargon, and then he's all reading me here.
Oh yeah. Jeez, my bad.
We're talking about the yield curve and derivatives at some point. What is your number one call to action for people of your generation? And I I'm not asking you to reveal your age, but I know you're younger than a traditional millennial. You're relatively fresh out of your undergrad. What's your number one piece of advice?
Yeah, I just think for Canadians, it's max out your TFSA or try to work towards, you know, even if you do have excess room, trying to at least get to let's say it's 6K for next year or this year. Try to work towards that, right? I think that's an easy start. I think there's a lot of parameters around an RSP and that money being locked up, but TFSA, it's quite, fluid, and you can kind of just put it in, get started, introduce yourself to investing, get a good brokerage, low fee, cost brokerage.
Is that based on the assumption that the individual has already eliminated their credit card debt?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay.
Have that assumption. They would hear your advice and think, oh yeah, great, I'm doing that. And they're sitting on $2,000 in an outstanding balance.
No, absolutely. I mean, like, listen, you're not going to beat 19.99% with an investment return. So I would say, yeah, there's definitely a priority. Like, first, make sure you're taking care of that high interest debt, and then, you know, I would say emergency fund, have some cash, take care of that high interest debt, pay that down, and then work towards investing. But I think for a lot of 18-year-olds, 19-year-olds that I'm talking to, fortunately, they haven't had a chance to get into credit card debt. So,
right,
just, you know, put the money into the TFSA first. And
let's
and
not
that's
give
sort of
them
what
that chance. Let's yeah, exactly. not give them that chance.
Exactly.
Nathan, thank you for your time today.
Absolutely. I really appreciate it, Bruce. Appreciate
Nathan,
it.
Nathan you. Kennedy, personal finance content guy on TikTok, on Instagram. He also hosts a podcast called New Money. He joined us from Ancaster, Ontario. That is it for our show today. A thank you to our sponsors, Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country, and a home equity bank, provider of the CHIP reverse mortgage. If you want to stay up to date on all things Moolala, it's very simple to do so. You can sign up to our newsletter. Moolala.ca is where you go to do that. And you just tick in your email address. We send it out once a month, and we will never do anything else with your address other than send you that newsletter. You can also subscribe to the podcast anywhere you get your podcasts. And while you're there, leave us a review. How about that? I am the money columnist as well for a TV show called Cityline. So cityline.tv is where you can see some more segments on money with a lifestyle spin. On social media, I'm at Bruce Celery on Twitter, Bruce Celery Moolala on Facebook. Thank you so much for joining us, and have a great day.